And you're listening to The Science Show on ABC Radio National, and you can get us online at abc.net.au/rn. And that's where our next guest listens every week online from his lab in San Diego, California, Andrew Dixon.
Here we are in Southern California on a sunny February day, looking out at the ocean. It's about 100 meters away. Beautiful, flat, blue, very nice.
Very nice, but becoming rather more acid. Of course, this is the place at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography where Keeling, famously over 50 years ago, measured CO2 in the atmosphere. Now, you got to do the same thing in the ocean.
I started working with Dave Keeling a little over 20 years ago, improving our ability to measure CO2 in the oceans.
And of course, it affects marine life in ways which are becoming more and more serious.
Yes, one thing that's obvious is that we're going to change the chemistry, the chemical composition of the oceans. And it's becoming more and more apparent there's a large number of species that have calcium carbonate as part of their system that are detrimentally affected by this. The corals, if they grow more slowly, that's a problem for them because corals typically are in a high energy zone where the rate at which they grow is important to them continuing and staying near the surface where the light is and able to resist the waves.
Way back when you began, was David Keeling aware, as he was meticulously in the atmosphere, that there may have been a problem of different kinds in the ocean?
When I began, Dave Keeling's interest was establishing what he liked to think of as a Mauna Loa of the sea, the ability to see a time series change in the ocean where you could understand how much of the CO2 from man's use of fossil fuels was ending up in the oceans. The difficulty was we knew how much had been burned, and we knew how much was in the atmosphere because you could see the change in composition of the atmosphere that Dave Keeling measured so assiduously at Mauna Loa and a number of stations. But you couldn't so easily say how much had gone into the ocean as opposed to going into land plants. And Dave felt that watching it change in the ocean would be the key to understanding this.
Now that's the key word, of course, watching. I had the vague idea that you dipped your instrument into the ocean wherever you happened to be, and out came a reading saying either the pH, in other words, the alkalinity or lack thereof, acidification, and some reading of CO2. It's not as simple as that, is it?
Not really, no. When you dissolve CO2 in the ocean, there's a variety of carbon dioxide species, CO2, bicarbonate, carbonate. One of the effects of the CO2, it reacts with the carbonate to form extra bicarbonate. So the total amount of dissolved CO2 changes, it increases, but one of the more important things for many of the biological processes is that the concentration of carbonate ion decreases. And this is a key component of a variety of biological reactions to form calcium carbonate skeletons.
So what do you do here, using Scripps as a base in La Jolla, California, to help people around the world do that very measurement?
My lab has worked now for about 18 years on advising people on how to make good CO2 measurements, but also distributing a standard seawater, basically Californian seawater that has been sterilized and then very carefully analyzed and distributed around the world for others to use as a way to calibrate their system or to test that their measuring system is working. For instance, last year we distributed 4,600 bottles of this seawater to, I think it was about 70 labs in about 25 countries. And the result of this is that as people write papers and put together data sets measured in different places at different times, we can agree that these are good data that can be used to get a coherent picture of how the oceans are changing.
I had no idea that it was as complicated as that. I thought you just had a little gizmo. But it's rather appropriate, given the history of Scripps with CO2, that it should be happening from here. So what sort of picture are you getting of CO2 and acidification increasing?
One thing clearly is that you can see there are increases in the CO2 in the oceans, and therefore you can infer the changes in pH, the changes in acidity due to this. It's a little more complicated because along the coasts and regions where there's different mixing of water, you can also get changes that look like high CO2 levels, whereas it's really deeper water mixing up. And so it's apparent that the oceans are increasing. People have started to put that into numerical models to predict what it would look like in the coming tens and hundreds of years. Harder is to try to ascertain what the biological consequences of this is. And we're just starting a program to try and look at that here at Scripps. And we're going to be looking at commercially important organisms for California, looking at how well oysters grow, or sea urchins, and the abalone.
Yes, I did a story from the University of Otago in Dunedin, South Island of New Zealand, where they're similarly measuring the coastline waters and finding that there's a huge difference of acidity and CO2, presumably, and also giving advice to fishers for that sort of growth. So it's going on everywhere.
Yes, one of the things we're hoping to build up with this, establish an observing system along the western coast of the US to try and see if we can ascertain how important the CO2 changes are locally, and thus offer advice to people, particularly those in the mariculture industry.
We've heard a little bit recently about ways to manipulate that by sticking various things in the ocean, including iron, doing so off a particular set of islands. Is there much prospect of that, or is the scale just too huge?
My own opinion is that the scale is really huge. If you were to look at how much CO2 has been produced by burning fossil fuels since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, it's more than a trillion tons. That is a million million tons. That's a huge amount of CO2. One ton of CO2, if you were to freeze it out like solid carbon dioxide, is about the size of an office desk. 1 billion tons, 1,000 million, would be a cubic kilometer of CO2. 1 trillion tons is 1,000 cubic kilometers of solid CO2. 40% of that is still in the atmosphere. That's why the atmospheric concentrations went up. To make significant changes, you have to move significant amounts of CO2.
The challenge is huge. Let's end on a pleasant note. You're a listener to ABC Radio National. How did that come to be, podcasting over here in California?
Interestingly, I learned about the program when a news article, I think, appeared possibly on a random Google search I was doing, where a former student of mine, Joellen Russell from the University of Arizona, was interviewed by you, Robin. And I thought, that sounds fun. And I looked on the web and found that I could listen to this show, not just read the interview text, and have been listening regularly ever since.
Professor Andrew Dixon, listening to The Science Show in San Diego, California. And I hope his boss, Tony Haymet, is listening too, because he's on next. Dr. Haymet is the Australian director of Scripps, and he's also concerned about ocean acidification. So what's the state of play in 2009?
Well, sad to say, I'm much more worried about it than I was when I last talked. And that's really based clearly on the measurements of a scientist called Dick Feely, who works for NOAA in Seattle. And Dick measured the acidity of the waters off the coast of California during the summer period, the summer upwelling season, and found very highly acidic water, much more acidic than I would ever have dreamed. And I think more acidic than the real experts would have dreamed. So we now know that the acidity changes over the annual cycle, that we can't just measure the acidity in Bermuda and Hawaii as Dave Keeling himself did starting 20 years ago. So we're a little bit behind the curve in having the time and spatially resolved data in ocean acidity. In terms of the effect on the whole food web of the ocean, I think, again, I'm more concerned now than I was 2 years ago.
Some people have suggested that there could be mega schemes to do something about it, you know, chucking all sorts of things into the ocean. What do you think of those sorts of schemes?
Not much. First of all, I'm always in favor of working out the theoretical implications of all of these geoengineering schemes. And, you know, we've had some of our Nobel Prize winners working out, you know, what happens when you put sulfates in the upper troposphere or something. The ones in the ocean seem particularly dumb to me, because any kind of carbon sequestration scheme, someone's going to ask you to verify that a ton of carbon has been buried. You know, if you do that in a redwood tree or in a rainforest or even biochar, then it's pretty easy to go out there and have graduate students make measurements, and you can see over a period of years that the carbon still is in the ground. To actually prove that a certain amount of carbon has been added to the ocean is an extraordinarily difficult thing. One I might add that would bring untold wealth to this institution So, you know, I don't want to argue against our livelihood because the guys here are the experts in designing robots to go out and measure various pieces of ocean chemistry. But to prove that someone polluting the ocean with extra iron actually locks away carbon, and then to prove it that's going to be there for thousands of years, is an extraordinarily difficult thing. So from my point of view, we don't understand the science. We don't have the robots necessary to prove that the carbon's locked away. And even if we did, it would be so expensive compared to other methods whose proof you could verify more easily that I don't see any prospect economically that it's going to work out. Quite apart from that, it probably violates the London Convention on Dumping and any number of other international conventions. So all in all, I would save my money and look at another scheme.
And so when we're looking at something really substantial like the Great Barrier Reef in Australia or the one in the West, which is pretty damn big as well, off the coast of Western Australia, is there anything we can do apart from some of these global things to reduce CO2 in the atmosphere in any case to alleviate the problem?
I think we can. I mean, the Great Barrier Reef has a triple threat. It's the pollution and runoff. Whenever we have these heavy rains, these days, inadvertently, agricultural chemicals get washed down the rivers. I don't think anyone anymore is deliberately doing that because it's just throwing money down the drain, literally. So we have the pollution runoff, we have the temperature effect, and we have the acidity effect. You know, any one of those would be a huge stress on the reef. I think we can do things about the runoff. It's very hard to imagine scalable schemes that would help the reef survive long periods at high temperature or substantial changes of more than a month or so to the ocean acidity. But I think there's still more we can do with the cooperation of farmers and other people to actually save money and get less sewage and less agricultural runoff into the reef. You know, it's like a human being. I think what we've learned from about reefs over the years is that stresses build up. And if you add three sources of stress, then, you know, you're going to get a heart attack. And I think we should attack the ones that are easily within our reach, and that's the kind of runoff ones. So I think there's been a change since we last talked. I think this topic of ocean acidity that wasn't in Al Gore's movie, that hasn't been in the headlines, has started to get some traction. And fortunately, there's some resources available in a competitive environment.
Tony Haymet, the Australian director of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography.